Wise Awards are back for 2024 and early bird entries are still open. These awards recognise the best use of digital media, marketing and commerce, and they also celebrate innovation and expertise right across the digital marketing industry. There are more categories than ever before to enter, so visit exchangewire.com/events to find out more.
The MarTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to today's MarTech Podcast, bringing you the latest from the worlds of media, marketing and commerce. I'm your host, John Still, and I'm delighted to be joined today by ExchangeWire COO, Lindsay Rountree. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Always good to have you on the show. And joining us today from Singapore is a very special guest, Erin Williams, Sales Director APAC at CNN. Erin, welcome to the show. Really good to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you both, John and Lindsay. It's a pleasure to be joining you today.
No, absolutely great to have you on. Looking forward to getting your perspective on our three stories.
I'm delighted to hear it's your first ever podcast.
It is. Lindsay.
Can't wait.
You've outed me. It is. So hello, listeners. Just be patient with me. It's my first time podcasting.
They're used to car crashes on this podcast. So I'm sure this will be a vast improvement to some of the things me and John have done over the years.
That's absolutely true. It's a good week when we've both read the stories. So
It is, exactly. We're prepared this week. So, you know.
Well, I'll move us on to the first one and see how prepared you are, Lindsay.
Oh, no.
So, first story, and WARC is expecting global ad spend to exceed $1 trillion this year. This is the first time the $1 trillion mark has been passed. North America is predicted to show the strongest growth this year with an increase of around 8.6%, while the UK is expected to see growth of around 8%. Meanwhile, APAC, the world's second largest market by ad spend generally, is going to see its growth slow to 2%. Erin, I'll throw to you first on this one. How do you feel about those numbers and that growth and the general state of the industry?
Yeah, I think it's definitely in line with expectations given what's happening in the world, but certainly in this part of the world. 2024 was the year of elections. We had half the world voting, as I'm sure you've talked about extensively. And I think that's directly impacted, well, has directly impacted the outlook for Asia Pacific. So when you have those big elections in India, Indonesia and Taiwan, how the then transition of power and some of those changes are then going to flow on is to be expected. So I'm really positive about Asia Pacific in general in the short and medium to long term. This is the most exciting region in the world. I'm very proud to be sitting right in the heart of it. And I think, well, I know that the ad spend is definitely going to be driven in the Northern Hemisphere by the US election in the US market. We know, obviously, working at CNN and how much advertising revenue is generated around that, both from political advertising, of course, and the nature that's directly aligned with the election itself, but also those brands really looking to capitalize on that audience surge. So, I think it's positive, even 2% is still growth, right? So I think given the situation of what's taking place and, you know, there's still very significant economic challenges in this part of the world. We're faced with a really strong US dollar as well, which is really impacting economies such as Japan and South Korea. China's economic output is obviously very well documented that it is much slower than expected. So I think we've still got growth. It's slow, but it's positive, and I feel really, really positive about the opportunities for this region.
Excellent. And yeah, like you say, you know, 2% growth, it might have slowed, but it is still growth. Lindsay, how are you feeling about these results and the jump over the $1 trillion mark?
I think that it's incredible that we've got to that stage where we're talking in the trillions, and I realize it's only $1 trillion, but talking in the trillions when it comes to ad spend. It does really show you kind of where this can go and how much growth we can expect. It's great to see that there's basically growth across the board. I mean, the US growth of 8.6% is North America growth. Obviously, you know, as Erin obviously pointed out, is going to be very, very election heavy. And so it's quite good to see that the UK kind of got quite near that at 8%, where, you know, of course we had an election as well, but, you know, our advertising spend is not quite so dominated by election years because of the laws around what you can do in terms of advertising during elections across the different platforms. So it's great to see that, you know, we're doing well given we've had lots of economic challenges. I think, you know, I'm just going to echo everything Erin said. 2% growth for APAC is still growth. It's not to be sniffed at. APAC is a very, very different region from arguably everywhere else. There's so many different nuances to it that have to be considered when you look at what growth looks like in that area. And I wonder if, you know, when you look at what the top growing channels were, it came up as social media, followed by search, and then they expect retail media to be the biggest growing channel over the next 3 years. All of those are huge in APAC, but they've always been much bigger in APAC, arguably, than they have been in other regions as well. So if other regions are seeing kind of growth to APAC levels, that could also explain why maybe APAC growth has slowed, because if you look at things like live commerce, social commerce, they're so big, and, you know, how that impacts retail media as well. They're already so big in that region, certainly the likes of China and Southeast Asia, that it's, you know, arguably the rest of the world was catching up in terms of that regard. So that, I think, is interesting. And I also wonder, you know, Erin can tell me if I'm talking rubbish from a kind of the perspective of a publisher working with advertisers, but I wonder if kind of like minimal growth is an opportunity for advertisers to kind of take stock and reset, maybe, and look at where are our growth opportunities going forward. Can we look at it as an opportunity to be more innovative? We're not trying to chase after the same numbers that maybe the rest of the world is trying to chase after. We've already seen that maturity in certain channels. What can we do that's more innovative and more interesting? And how can we use this as an opportunity to look at things differently?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that taking stock. We've recently commissioned a global business decision makers mindset research piece. And there were some really key insights that came out of that, especially around, now we know from this part of this world, and that's what you're talking to as well, that technological advancements, potentially other regions are catching up with. And I think, you know, like you mentioned, that really leading the way in areas such as social commerce. But one of the key challenges that's coming up for business decision makers is that cybersecurity and technology piece as well. It is their most primary concern for the next 12 months. And I think what that's going to do is take a look at where the spend's going, looking obviously the return on investment and the performance of that, but also making sure that they're investing in safe and sustainable ways, in secure ways with certain partners, and that they're not being put in any sort of jeopardy at all from a brand or a customer experience perspective. So I think there may have been a bit of a coming together of, because this region has grown so fast with such a proliferation of options, okay, let's take stock. What's working? What's not? What are our risks? Where, you know, in the social space, are we spending too much of our budget there? Do we know that we have the integrity around all of our digital buying that we want to make sure that we have in place? So I think they're probably working with agencies to do that. And that may be just holding up some of the revenue flowing through as well to the ad market.
I also, what I wonder, and Erin, again, I've had differing perspectives on this when speaking to people in the region, but there is an argument that certainly in kind of the burgeoning Southeast Asian markets, there has been a bit of a race to the bottom when it comes to CPMs. And I wonder what impact that has on growth as well, because it's been very much a volume game. Kind of everything is so focused on numbers, like, yeah. Is that actually causing the kind of growth to be, albeit positive, to decline as well?
Yeah, especially when we're looking at the revenue, right? Because it is very much that race to the bottom. I mean, some CPMs in some markets are, you know, very, very, very small. And I think that's definitely something, well, certainly in the conversations that I have with brand marketers and leaders, okay, we're getting the reporting on the inventory where things have been delivered and the effective CPMs, but how, like, is it still providing that quality that we want out of our investments? So yeah, I think that's a very good point, especially in Southeast Asia. I mean, what publishers are going to start giving inventory for free? Like, it's very, very small margins, right? And we're not going to be doing that, and we don't. We have a very premium model, but in terms of just the sheer volume of inventory, I guess, across all of the platforms available and all of the touch points and ways that brands can reach their audiences in these markets. And yeah, and I guess that the roles that some of the big tech partners play in that, and also some of the big agency groups as well, just they need to interrogate that. They obviously need to look at those yield situations as well.
Yeah, definitely. One of the stats that jumped out at me, which might be of interest to you, Erin, is that the second strongest growth channel is expected to be connected TV, growing by 19.6%. Linear has also grown by 1.9%, which is really interesting. But, you know, in terms of CNN and what you're doing, that 19.6 for streaming must be quite encouraging as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's already an area that we're innovating and moving into. So we have connected TV channels or FAST channels, so free ad-supported channels across 16 European markets in the US, and it will be rolled out in the Asia-Pacific region in the coming quarters. We're just working on the plan on that on a market-by-market. And then the addition of the fact that we're CNN is part of the Warner Brothers Discovery family, we're now got a streaming service essentially on the Max platform. So in Europe, that is just launched. So CNN International is now being streamed live, the channel, onto the Max streaming platform. And that's already been in place in the US for a number of months. We are seeing really encouraging and interesting trends with that CTV audience because it is younger. And the content that we're producing to curate on those platforms is very different to what we're doing on our linear channels. It is a completely customized for platform curated content. So essentially 3-hour blocks of updates and breaking news coupled with some of our news adjacent content. So travel, style, lifestyle, health content as well. Designed because we understand the consumption is people are dipping in and out of CTV to get the news they need and kind of moving through. It's also providing us a really good opportunity for targeting for our advertisers as well and to reaching new audiences, differentiating and providing more video inventory across our network as well. So we're not just confined to what's on our owned and operated and our YouTube platforms, obviously, of our website and mobile apps. We now have CTV as part of the mix and streaming, which has been very well received by market. So we're really excited for when it rolls out into our region. I can't tell you which markets will be first, but it's not too far away. It's not too far away.
Amazing. Well, we'll, yeah, keep an eye out for that for sure. I will lead us into our second story now, which is that Google has joined a $250 million deal to support newsrooms in California. The 5-year deal would let Google avert a proposed state bill that could force tech companies to pay news organizations when advertising appeared alongside articles on the tech company's platform. This is interesting that Google are, you know, positing that they are supporting the news. Erin, how do you feel this would most likely affect online publishers, and what's been your experience of that so far?
So covering news, global news, is a very expensive business. The resource and cost is a very intensive operation. And at CNN, we're commercially funded. So we are funded by advertising, distribution, content agreements, and licensing agreements. We don't receive any government funding, unlike, you know, other news publishers around the world. And we've all seen and been part of the decline of the traditional media business revenue, but the cost of news hasn't gone down. That's still going up. And I think it's really important for each media owner and each brand to be responsible for their revenue and make sure they're building sustainable revenue streams to support the operational costs of their business. That's just basic business, right? But there has just been such a proliferation of and a flood of revenue to these other platforms. So I'm not, this is my kind of personal opinion now, I guess, rather than a CNN opinion. And I can take a look at what's happened in Australia. So I'm Australian, as everybody's probably figured out by now. And there was the introduction of the new media bargaining code designed to ensure that some of the revenue that was generated from Meta and Google found its way back to the news publishers to make sure that can continue to fund the important, trustworthy journalism taking place in Australia. And As a result of that, quite a number of the news businesses, I believe there was 80 involved that individually negotiated terms with Google and Meta, resourced their editorial departments accordingly, were able to allocate additional funding to certain areas to ensure that there was, they were generating important news coverage out of the market. Now, Meta has decided to not renew those agreements in the same terms with a lot of the publishers. So this is just me looking from a bit of a distance in Singapore, and what's happened is that 200 odd million dollars of revenue, Australian dollars of revenue that had come through in the last couple of years, is it going or is it risk? So that directly impacts on those traditional media businesses and the staff and the journalists and their roles and their jobs. And there's already been some significant cost measures across like the Nine Group recently. News Corporation has done the same. I think from my perspective, we don't have those in this agreement in the markets that we work in with Google and Meta. We weren't part of that new media bargaining in Australia. But the most important thing is that businesses need to find and shape new revenue streams themselves, and they've got to. It's very much imperative that the responsibility lies with the media organisation to craft really creative partnerships, whether that's with platforms or other channels and media partners. It's part of the evolution. It's a really important part of it. We can't turn back time and turn off social media and no one gets the news from there anymore. Like, we are so far past that. And I think pointing the blame game or saying, all the revenue's gone there and sort of throwing your hands in the air is not the way forward. We know where audiences are and how can we connect with them and how can we utilize the strength of our content, our award-winning and trusted journalism and our brand to make sure that we're providing new revenue streams. So whether that comes from, a whole range of mechanisms are being explored. So that may be renegotiating with some of these partners. It may be like many of news organisations have done with, having a direct-to-consumer, exploring that subscriber model. So how we can leverage further our brand. So a good example at CNN is we have a division within our content and licensing team called CNN Academy. So what that is essentially is that's an education product that we work with universities, private companies, other media organizations to provide news gathering, like training essentially, journalist courses for young journalists. That has a commercial element attached to it. So that's a new revenue stream that's providing value, that's looking for different diversification of revenue streams, basically.
Yeah. Lindsay, how do you feel about how this deal can impact online publishers? And, as Erin mentioned, there's been the example from Australia and how that's gone. But yeah, how do you feel Google maybe should be supporting publishers?
I mean, obviously, the new media bargaining code in Australia hasn't gone particularly well. But I would, the first thing I read when I read the article when it came out, was it last week? I can't remember. My first thought was, well, Google wins here. And I still stand by that. But actually, everything Erin said has kind of made me change my stance a bit. I'm still going to go into my stance, but I'm also going to kind of caveat it with a lot of what Erin said about the fact that publishers need to be the ones to take responsibility for what's happening in their own businesses. And we can't rely on everybody else to try and fix it for us. That is the nature of, evolution, which is a really, really good point. I think that what Google's done here, and John, up front, you mentioned the kind of Google doing this allows them to basically avert a proposed state bill. And I was looking into what that state bill is. And from what I can find, it refers to two state bills. So one is AB 866 and the other is SB 1327, if you really care about legal codes. So AB 866 would have meant tech companies pay publishers a percentage of ad revenues for linking to their articles. And the second one, SB 1327, proposes a 7.25% tax on ad revenue to create a tax credit for newsrooms. You could argue that $250 million for California newsrooms up front over a course of 5 years is brilliant and will massively help them. But you could also argue if Google and other tech companies, because it's not just Google on the hook here, if all tech companies were on the hook for having to pay that tax and pay a proportion of ad revenue for linking to articles over the course of, you know, however long the state bill lasts for, ideally forever, but depends on what governments choose, etc., that would arguably cost them a lot more money over the course of the time. So Google have kind of taken one for the team a bit, I would say, because Google, confirming they're going to help fund this alongside taxpayer revenue, alongside private sources, are going to kind of help out the rest of tech that don't have to pay this potential fee that would have been put forward in California against these bills. But it likely would save them a lot of money over the long run, because if you argue every single, you know, if California do it as well, what states are going to follow suit and also force these bills? And could it become a federal bill that every newsroom or every publisher across the entire country has to pay? What's that going to look like for Google, for Meta, for everybody else that would be on the hook for this? Arguably, it'd be a lot more than $250 million over 5 years that Google are currently helping to partially fund. But I do want to now touch on what Erin said about the fact that, you know, publishers need to take responsibility for this. It's very much, you look at other industries, you know, evolution happens, change happens, and they have to understand that they have to, it's very much, sadly, evolve or die. What steps can they take to ensure that they are evolving, looking at partnerships, looking at everything else, all the things that Erin mentioned? I think that is a very, very good point. I think things like this are amazing if they continue. And as, you know, as we've seen in Australia, that the longevity wasn't there and it was helpful for a time, but now it's back on the owners of the publishers to have to do their work to diversify and find new revenue streams. We can't rely on tech, we can't rely on governments. So what do we do instead? We run the business, we have to work out ways of making it survive.
Yeah, absolutely no doubt that you've done your research this week, Lindsay. Not one, but two actual legal bills quoted.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Kudos to me. Thank you very much.
Indeed.
I read something.
Yeah, as both of you have touched on there, I think one of the interesting parts is that the toothpaste is not going back into the tube in terms of the social media relationship with publishers. There's been, you know, it's a couple of decades now since the real emergence of this and how this has impacted newsrooms. And yeah, it's the evolve or die argument is really, really interesting. Erin, any further thoughts on this story?
We don't want brands like CNN, BBC, New York Times, we don't want them to die, because news has been more important than ever. Impartial, trusted, reliable, factual news from diverse sources is so important. And so that's not to say, oh, we'll just all come to work for free and we'll just everybody. There has to be revenue behind it. And you know, we do need a supportive media ecosystem to really help us do that. But I think we can't just turn around and blame one specific thing. We've got to look at new mechanisms and really be creative about how we explore new revenue opportunities that deliver really great outcomes for all of the parties involved.
Yeah, definitely. On that, I'm actually going to move us on to our third and final story, which is along similar lines, to be honest, in terms of the future of news and digital news in particular. And this is a piece that we published on Exchange Wire from Matt Broughton. And how do we ensure the future of digital news funding? In light of some recent revelations around the funding of digital news content, alongside yet more damaging industry stories on brand safety, we discussed what more can be done to fund impartial news content. I know this is something very close to your heart, Erin. This is sadly, you couldn't make ATS Singapore, but this is something that we would have touched on stage. Do you think, what is the situation with funding news content? The stat from the article is that Group M have said that only 1.2% of ad funding is going to news content digitally. Why are advertisers shying away from news content, and why shouldn't they, basically?
Yeah, this was really high on the agenda at Cannes. And it wasn't just from the news orgs, that all really collectively came together. And I know John Williams from BBC was quoted in the article that we're referencing. We've all come together, but it's not just the news orgs coming together with this story. We had very senior leaders from brands and the big holding group agencies really putting this on the agenda at Cannes. how and why advertisers should commit to funding news through aligning and supporting the high-quality journalism. Why it's so important that we have this thriving news ecosystem that's in all of our interests. It's vital for informing people, holding power to account. That's now made its way to all of the very senior levels of our industry. And it's really up to us to challenge these perceptions, because we don't know, I don't exactly know how it's evolved, this, let's call it this brand safety concern around news, because what we know is that it's not only just about funding journalism and holding power to account and doing the good. Campaigns on news work very well for brands and advertisers. They work. There is plenty of data around that. And I don't know if some of this comes in that to that race to the bottom that we touched on earlier. We are a premium because we have a very premium audience. We have a premium brand halo, not just CNN. I'm talking about everybody in our sector. And you know, there's plenty of data. There was IAB research that found 69% of people said there's no negative effect on how they perceive a brand if they see it adjacent to disconcerting news. It's just not a fact. And I think that the contradiction to this is when so much of the money, like the president of Unilever USA was talking about how much of 20% of their spend is going on social, and some of the content that is being presented around, that's concerning. Like that also, there's obviously a lot more rigor now coming into that, but that's concerning. We don't do that to our brands. And I think what we're trying to do is shift the conversation from brand safety to brand suitability. Like, is this environment suitable for your brand? The first check is if it's on one of the big international global news sites, yes, of course it is. This is a premium environment with high quality content to put your brand next to, with an audience that we know is highly engaged. They're coming to us for information about how to navigate the world. There is no better space to put your brand than that. And we work with some of the largest corporate and government clients, and our campaigns just continue to deliver. Like, we call it the CNN effect. So there is a disproportionate and tangible impact that is delivered to brands. And maybe that's the thing. Maybe it's sometimes not always as easy to measure with the data, because there is this halo that comes from it that we can't deliver like some of the more performance-based platforms can offer. But we know that there is, the brands that advertise with us see a 50% on average uplift in brand awareness and at least 20% uplift in purchase intent. We can do a whole lot of research to support that. And I think understanding how we got to this place is important, but I think now it's really up to us as an industry to go, okay, right, let's just actually look at all the facts here and look at what's going to serve and deliver the best campaign for all, you know, outcome for all parties.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area, and a lot of what you've touched on there, I think in particular the move from brand safety to brand suitability as a concept is, you know, it's something we're going to see more of. Lindsay, how do you feel about this story, and in particular, you know, the funding of news and how we ensure its future?
I mean, literally nothing to add on what Erin said, so thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Excellent. Good. We're done. You read one of the stories, right?
Erin's response was extremely comprehensive and a real kind of like call to arms, which obviously I love, and it's really, really good to hear it from the horse's mouth. I'm not calling you a horse, Erin, obviously. but it is like, you know, obviously the very point of news is that news is polarizing, and we have to accept that, and also accept that, you know, as Erin highlighted, the vast majority of people do not shy away from seeing an advertiser appear against this polarizing news content. In fact, you could argue it's still appearing in a premium environment, it's still appearing against premium quality content, and give the consumer some credit. They understand that. They understand the context with which that ad is appearing against it. And so we do have to give the end user, the reader, more credit in this regard, because we we're just assuming that they're not going to want to see that. And obviously, social media hasn't helped here, because the second something bad appears against something else, it's blasted all over social media, and it, you know, gives everybody involved a very, very bad name and affects their reputation. But we have to, again, also look at the context of these things. These are one-off things. There are times when thing, you know, when an ad will appear against some bad content, and there are so many stories with our industry. But when that's happened, you know, against things like porn sites and that kind of stuff, and it's, you know, they're always met with a bit of a titter and a laugh. But they obviously are quite serious, and those are the examples that then go viral and cause a brand to go, right, I'm shutting everything off, and cause a brand to only rely on suppression lists, only rely on block lists, and really, really be very, very strict in how they are targeting content. I'd like to think that, you know, as we move away from a third party, like focusing and relying on third party cookies, because hopefully, despite what Google have said, we are anyway, and that's the route everyone's going down. There are more ways of targeting. I'm not talking about like replacements to cookies like Universal ID, but more ways of targeting, looking at things like the context, and we'll realize that actually contextual is very, very powerful. And the more we look at this, and, you know, Erin talked about the data that CNN has and how they can use that effectively to help their advertisers realize who they're speaking to and who they're advertising against, that will make things more interesting. Because the concern as well is that the more the advertisers shy away from advertising in premium news environments against content that could be considered by some as polarizing, it forces them to change tack on the kind of content they are publishing in the first place, to try to get the few advertisers that will spend to get them over the line, making it even more polarizing, which makes the rest of the advertisers even further, like, shy away even further from actually advertising in those kinds of environments. So there's a lot that can be done here. I was in Cannes myself, and I did notice a lot of the conversation being around that, and it's fascinating that actually everyone is coming together. What I want to see now is there's clearly education required from the publisher perspective, and Erin already talked about brand safety versus brand suitability. We're seeing that become the word du jour of, you know, to help people understand the context of that behind. It's not about safety. It's not been about safety for a long time. Actually, in terms of safety, things are good. It's definitely around what I'm appearing against. Is that right for my brand? That's definitely a suitable conversation rather than a safety conversation. But also the advertisers need to, and the agencies need to help them kind of move away from that. And I get it's a big change going from literally blocking almost every keyword to then saying, right, we're going to open this up, we're going to look at context. It's a massive change. It needs to be gradual, otherwise they're going to have an absolute fit when they see what things they're appearing against. But it needs to be collaborative and collective.
Yeah, so absolutely the brand image and the reputational damage is the key concern. I can understand how that's at the agency level, at the client level, once bitten, twice shy, right? There's probably been, you know, like you'd said, there's many examples well publicised and of where those things go wrong. But one of the really interesting things is that more and more business decision makers are leaning on their personal values as well as the company values to make choices. And we're seeing so many organizations and corporations really lean into the DEI, say all of the right things. This is what we stand for as a brand, as a company. But then we're seeing a lot of those keywords as blocked keywords on content around those issues. Now, I think that that's something that needs to be challenged, and I understand that often I think it might not be at the high level, they're probably not aware of such things. It's someone just trying to do the right thing that's blocked all these keywords because of they're worried about any potential backlash. But if you're saying as a brand, or we stand for these are our values, you need to walk the walk and support that content that is being produced and shared and created around such issues, right? That's the thing for us, is that I think often we do see these block lists that are, you know, super, super long and in depth, where it's like, no, but that's not what your brand is. That's not what you're telling your brand values are. So let's align that. Let's make sure that what you're communicating is actually authentic and true, and help us, you know, shine more light on such issues as well. The other really important part of CNN and like a lot of the other organizations as well, is we do very much work with companies that have those same shared values. Now, this is really important in the ESG space. especially around anything to do with sustainability, because we know how gun-shy everybody is about being tarnished as greenwashing. We completely get that. And when businesses work with us to share their narrative around that and what they're doing and their initiatives, they know they can do that with the confidence that we will treat everything we produce in partnership with them with the same vetting and rigor that we would if we were producing a news article. So we will basically, we've had clients come to us saying, we want to say this. And we're like, yeah, but that's not true. It's not quite the angle that you should, you're not there yet. Let's talk about the journey to getting to where you say you're going to be. Like, people are really open and receptive to that. We know consumers care more and more and more about these ESG claims and initiatives. People are making purchasing decisions based on it. So I think we're a very good partner in that, making sure we've got that shared value really locked down. And it's because our reputation is at stake and so is theirs. And we understand that and you know, really having that trust with them as well.
Do you feel like they're in? Sorry, yeah, carry on.
Sorry, go. No, you go.
I was going to say, do you feel like as, you know, it's more prevalent now that publishers and advertisers are having better direct relationships and direct communications and not relying on the tech in the middle so much? Well, you are obviously, but you know what I mean by this. The supply chain's getting a bit smaller. Do you feel like that's enabling you to have direct conversations with them and helping them and them being able to see you as the brand and understand what you are, what your values are, what you're about, and it makes that education piece a bit easier?
Yeah, it does. And we work with agency groups, but a very significant part of our business is direct client. Because just what we can command being CNN, we're at that C-suite. We can have those conversations. And people are very, at that level, very open and candid about their challenges and their concerns. And so we can then really work in very close partnership. Like I said, we do work with agencies as well as part of that mix, but we do seem to have that access, which is that helps us inform some of these key issues, right? Like this, and this is where the breakdown is. Okay, at the senior C-suite level, nobody would be aware of this blacklist of keywords and what that actually implies or what that's actually, you know, resulting in for your campaign delivery and what you're trying to do and what you're trying to stand for. So I think just being able to sort of remove some of those layers and get to the bottom of that information's is really important. And yeah, and just one more thing that you touched on that I should have looped back to was around that technology that we have now, that proprietary technology to make sure that we are assess the sentiment of articles and context of any content and have the ability to say, yes, this is somewhere that we know is suitable for this brand to appear, or no, we're not going to serve anything there. We have that. And it works extremely, extremely well. We have those rail guards, and we have a very big digital operations team working on that constantly. And we have extensive international client sales and servicing team as well that are hawkeye on anything. If there is any sort of disaster, anything, our team is onto it straight away. Like, okay, these are the campaigns. We need to make sure that, you know, everyone's protected. There's going to be no brand backlash. We're very hands-on. So I think that they're just making sure that there's those safeguards in place as well.
Yeah, that, you know, that, like you say, that safeguarding, having those rails there for advertisers, the education piece is important. I mean, in terms of block lists, we've seen recently that Paris was on a lot of block lists from people from the Bataclan incident 9 years ago, and that's taken away a lot of advertising from the Olympics coverage. It's really interesting stats coming out from how many people block that. I was talking to Caroline Fenner from Pink News the other day, and she was saying that brands still have Ariana Grande and Manchester on their block lists, which obviously cuts them off from an incredible amount of coverage. So it's fascinating. And yeah, like you said, the education piece is important because sometimes these block lists are historic and being passed on from person to person,
that's
department, and forgotten about.
Yeah,
they are only ever
added
to.
They're rarely reviewed. No one's cleaning it up going, it's springtime, let's just check what's on here. Yeah, okay. That's, the Paris one though, wow.
Yeah,
what
it's absolutely fascinating.
What a lost opportunity for so many brands and, oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, it's no, it's absolutely fascinating. But yeah, a really interesting space. And yeah, I think all of us would reiterate that news media is very well worth protecting and funding into the future. So
hear, hear.
Excellent. On that note, I will wrap everything up there. But I will just say, Erin, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a brilliant, brilliant discussion and been really great to get your insights. So thanks again for taking the time.
No, it's my very great pleasure. I'm very grateful for you thinking of me and bringing me on. It was lots of fun.
It was. And well done for your first podcast. I thought you were brilliant. Yes. If you hadn't mentioned, no one would have known.
So. Oh, okay, good.
If I hadn't outed her. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Sorry, Erin.
No, that's all good. Thanks so much.
No, you're welcome. And Lindsay, obviously, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you.
Excellent. Before we go, I just want to mention that it is ATS London coming up on September 11th. Last couple of weeks to get your tickets. Please take a look at the link I will put in the show notes and pick yours up before they all run out, which will be very shortly. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you next week.